This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Day of mourning and strike in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin after three Palestinians died in Israeli violence. People hit the streets in Tunisia to protest against President Kais Saied on the anniversary of the 2011 popular uprising in the North African country. Plus, Ukraine says Russia has carried out a missile attack on Kiev, targeting critical infrastructure. This is Muse. It's good to have you with us. Israeli crimes show no signs of letting up as regime forces killed another two Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. The two Palestinians were shot dead during an Israeli raid on a village near the city of Jenin. They were traveling in their car when Israeli forces opened fire on them. One of them was killed on the spot. The other later died of his injuries. Also on Saturday, another Palestinian succumbed to his wounds sustained during an Israeli raid near Jenin earlier this month. A day of public mourning and a citywide strike has been declared in Jenin. The latest deaths bring to 12 the number of Palestinians killed in the West Bank since the beginning of the year. The Israeli regime has stepped up attacks in the occupied territories over the past several months. Our correspondent from Ramallah, Mona Kandil, explains why the Israeli regime has intensified its crackdown against Palestinians.
It seems that the Israeli military's brutality shows no sign of abating. And there's a cracking down on not only Palestinian fighters, as we are saying, because they include children, they include civilians as well. The Israelis are targeting as well the general population here in the occupied territories. At the end of the day, Palestinians warn that more aggressive, policies by Israel's current right-wing regime led by Benjamin Netanyahu is expected because Netanyahu and the Israeli military wants to prove to the Israelis and the settlers in a way or another that they control the Palestinian territories. They would prevent Palestinian resistance, any form of resistance. And in the last year, over 180 Palestinians were killed. Many of them were known as Palestinian fighters, members of the newly formed groups, whether the Jenin Battalion or the Lion's Den in Nablus. So the Israeli regime doesn't want for Palestinians to be engaged in any form of resistance, and they don't want them, of course, to be engaged in confrontations and armed resistance and to shoot at the Israeli soldiers and the settlers.
The Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has concluded a two-day visit to Lebanon, where he held talks with the country's top officials. Both sides stressed the significance of implementing bilateral agreements, while Lebanon's foreign minister declared that foreign pressure is preventing the Arab country from acquiring much-needed assistance from Iran.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian held talks Friday in Beirut with top-ranking Lebanese officials. The Iranian official said in a joint presser with his Lebanese counterpart that Iran wishes to see problems and difficulties go away in Lebanon, reiterating a previous offer to help resolve Lebanon's electricity crisis.
We would like to officially stress once more that the Islamic Republic of Iran is fully ready with its advanced scientific, engineering, and technical expertise to rehabilitate the power plants in Lebanon and even build new plants if needed, on the condition that there is consensus on this matter.
Lebanese Foreign Minister Abdullah Bouhabib revealed that foreign pressure exerted against Lebanon as well as internal disputes have been obstacles in the way of acquiring assistance from Iran. Lebanon and Iran have signed numerous agreements since 1997. Yet observers say Lebanon has not implemented many of the accords as a result of Western pressure, primarily from the United States.
When we have certain factions in Lebanon that are cooperating with the U.S., then they become part of these sanctions, which are being imposed by the U.S. On the other hand, Iran wants to provide assistance to all Lebanese people. The fuel or gas that reaches Lebanon would not be for one sect or one community, but for all Lebanese, especially when they are all suffering a total blackout.
In 2012, Iran presented an offer to the Lebanese authorities under which Iran would provide fuel for electricity in a period of 6 months initially, while the Lebanese government could make down payments in Lebanese lira. Abdullahian later held separate meetings with Speaker Nabi Hibiri and caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati and discussed the latest developments in the region and ways to improve bilateral ties. Earlier, the Iranian minister also met with Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah and discussed the latest developments in Lebanon and Palestine, especially the threat posed by the Israeli regime. Iran's foreign minister stressed that the Islamic Republic will remain a good friend of Lebanon in hard times, but it seems Lebanon has been forced by foreign powers to turn down unconditional help during the most difficult juncture in its economic history. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
An Iranian national with British passport has been executed for spying for the UK government and, quote, extensive action against Iran's national security. Ali Reza Akbari was sentenced to death for more than 2 years after he was arrested. According to a court ruling, Akbari began working with the UK spy agency MI6 under the guise of research and trade activities. He had numerous meetings with UK agents in different countries over a long period. He passed on intelligence on key issues, including Iran's domestic and foreign policies, as well as missile and defense programs. Akbari also gave the UK information about nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was assassinated in November 2020. In the meantime, Iran's foreign ministry has summoned the British ambassador to Tehran to lodge a protest against what it called uncustomary UK interventions in matters concerning Iran's national security. That after the British foreign minister threatened Iran that Akbari's execution will not go unchallenged without elaborating further. Tunisians are holding protest rallies against the government of President Kais Saied, who is accused of power grab in the North African country. The rallies coincided with the anniversary of the 2011 popular uprising that led to the ouster of longtime President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. The protesters have vowed to defy police instructions to hold demonstrations in separate, specified areas. They say that they would march toward the Central Avenue in Tunis. Heavy police have been deployed in the area, housing the Interior Ministry. Anger has been boiling in the country since Saied shut down the elected parliament in 2021 and began to reshape the political system. His actions have been described by his critics, including most parties and the labor union, as a power grab. Some Tunisians have, however, welcomed his moves. Fighting rages on in the Ukrainian town of Soledar in eastern Donetsk amid conflicting reports on the fate of the fiercely contested town. Ukrainian officials say that they still have control of the front line of Soledar. That after Russia claimed it had taken over the salt mining town on Thursday, calling the victory an important step in its offensive. Meanwhile, explosions were heard in several Ukrainian regions on Saturday, including the capital Kiev. The Ukrainian presidential office said that critical infrastructure facilities were the target of the air raid. Russia has been pounding Ukraine's vital sectors, including its power grid, with missiles and drones since October, causing blackouts and disruptions. Earlier, our correspondent in Donetsk, Johnny Miller, updated us on the battle for the town of Soledar and assessed the prospect of new front lines in the Russia-Ukraine war.
The Ukrainians still saying that it hasn't, but now they're saying that Soledar isn't a very strategic town. It is a strategic town, and that's why the Ukrainians put up such a stiff resistance there. Right now, we're seeing some of the most brutal fighting, perhaps the most brutal fighting in the war so far. Dozens, probably hundreds, particularly Ukrainian soldiers, are getting killed or wounded every day. And Soledar is important because it makes it more likely for the Russians to be able to take Bakhmut. And Bakhmut's heavily fortified. The Russians have been trying to take that for months. So that'll be the next target for Russia. We're not really seeing any calls for peace at the moment, as Russia seems to have lost faith in Ukraine and NATO to negotiate for peace. And NATO has made clear that the only way they want to win this war is by sending more weapons. So critical days, weeks, and months ahead in this war on the front lines. There seems to be a lot of movement in Belarus. And Ukrainians are taking that seriously. As I say, we may well have some massive news in the coming days or weeks of a new, huge new offensive, or we may not. It's just very difficult to know at the moment. But certainly that's a major possibility, an invasion from Belarus. Or as I say, it may just be a ruse and we may well see an attack from elsewhere. Or we may well just see the Russians concentrating on this, their artillery barrage of Bakhmut and trying to win the fight for that city.
Sweden takes over the rotating presidency of the European Union with a vow to oppose Russia and support Ukraine. Critics say the EU's foreign policy towards Moscow is set to backfire even further during the year 2023. Jerome Hughes has more from Brussels.
Stockholm's government has just taken over the rotating presidency of the European Union. It holds the position for the next 6 months and faces many challenges. Amid the conflict in Ukraine, the powers that be in Moscow have been singled out.
This is the peaceful order that the Putin regime now seeks to destroy. But we will defend it here and in Ukraine and everywhere.
Many analysts say the EU has shot itself in the foot by provoking and isolating Russia at Washington's behest. Accommodation, food and energy prices remain extremely high in the EU. The European Parliament has just published results of a survey which shows cost of living is the number one concern for citizens.
Of course, I'm looking to go in and buy my own house at the moment. That's bit difficult to decide. Is it a good time? Is it not a good time?
Is the reliance on food banks is shocking. Even for people in full-time employment, like police officers, teachers.
For instance, Brussels, I think, is the city of trainees, of interns who try to start your career. And, for instance, you can have an internship that is not paid, and what you do?
The EU has sent 50 billion euro to Ukraine during the past 10 months, mostly to provide deadly weapons. Critics say the West wants to feed the arms industry and then make huge profits for Western companies when it finally comes to picking up the pieces.
We are preparing for Ukraine's reconstruction. The international donors platform that we set up with our G7 partners will be up and running this month.
Anti-war activists say many problems could have been averted if Moscow's security concerns had been listened to by NATO and the EU. Tourism industry representatives are asking the European Commission to intervene because in some EU countries, one-third of all rooms being offered by hotels and guest houses are currently being occupied by Ukrainian refugees. There's concern the bloc's tourism sector will be decimated this summer if the issue is not resolved. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
U.S. police brutality takes another victim. Unarmed black man Keenan Anderson died hours after he was repeatedly tasered and restrained by Los Angeles police following a traffic accident. Anderson, 31 years old, was a teacher and father. He was also a cousin of Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors. Anderson went into cardiac arrest several hours after the encounter on January the 3rd. Los Angeles police released body cam footage of the incident after it sparked outcry. They said that Anderson tried to run away after a car crash. The cause of his death has not been officially determined. Black Lives Matter says Anderson was killed by the police. His death brings to 3 the number of people killed in encounters with the LAPD in less than a week. Police brutality against black people is a source of public outcry in the U.S. Earlier, we talked to the co-founder of Black Agenda Report, Margaret Kimberly, on the police killings in America and the cause of so much police violence.
Well, this past year, in 2022, there were more than 1,100 police killings, an average of 3 people every day. On average, one of those persons will be black and 2 are not. But we have this country where it is acceptable. There's no point in sugarcoating it, where the police have this power over our lives, and it's more than 1,000 people a year. We have a culture that's violent, that's militarized, and there's no way for that not to trickle down to policing and the way that it's carried out, where the police, they police, as a verb, black people all the time, no matter they can have an accident. There's some people say he actually asked for police assistance after a car accident. It wouldn't be the first black person to die after calling for help, but the nature of policing is such that incidents like this, deaths like this, are inevitable.
Police in Brazil have arrested a former minister in connection with the recent riots by supporters of ex-president Jair Bolsonaro. Anderson Torres, who served as justice minister in Bolsonaro's cabinet, was detained in the capital, Brasilia, upon arrival from the U.S. The Supreme Court judge had issued a warrant for him for his alleged collusion with the rioters and was asked to get back to the country until Monday. Torres also stands accused of failing in his most recent job as security chief for the capital. He is among several former officials arrested as part of a probe recently launched by a senior judge. More than 2,000 people have been detained after a violent mob stormed key public buildings. They were angry over swearing in of Lula da Silva as the country's new president after the election in which Bolsonaro was defeated with a thin margin. China has reported around 60,000 COVID-related fatalities in just over a month as a fresh wave of outbreak continues to wreak havoc in the country. The official report by the country's health authorities says that the death toll was recorded between December 8, 2022 and January 12 this year. China has been experiencing a surge in COVID infections and deaths since the country suddenly decided to lift virus restrictions in December. The government lifted travel curbs and lockdowns amid nationwide protests. That does it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The recent UN climate summit in Egypt offered more brazen hypocrisy than usual because the world's rich countries once again lectured poor nations about the dangers of fossil fuels as they continue to use massive amounts of new gas, coal, and oil. An African climate change activist speaks here on the sidelines of the summit.
We have had several conferences of the parties on the continent, at least four of them. Each time they say it's African COP, but at the end of the day, it doesn't have the aspirations, the decisions don't meet the aspirations of African people. So we decided this time to come as African people, as ourselves, and write our history and tell our stories ourselves. And what is the story? The story is that of a continent that has been treated unjustly for the last couple of years. The African continent as a whole emits less than 4% of the global gas greenhouse gases, and yet the impacts of climate change are felt more in Africa than anywhere else.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on hypocrisy and double standards by Western countries regarding the utilization of fossil fuels in Africa as Europe battles an energy crisis triggered by the conflict in Ukraine. Stay with us as our experts give us their insight.
Africa, a victim of climate change hypocrisy. At the 27th meeting of the Conference of Parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, or COP27, held in Egypt last November, climate issues relating to Africa took center stage. Europe is facing an energy crunch, and countries in the continent are reopening coal plants. They are also actively looking to develop new sources of fossil fuel abroad, especially in Africa, where they had previously worked to block investments in the sector. Out of the 23 top investors in Africa's oil and gas projects, 14 are headquartered in the US, 6 in Europe, 1 in Canada, 1 in India, and 1 in South Africa.
Western countries that were calling for reduction of the use of fossil fuels before the Ukraine crisis are now financing fossil fuel expansion in Africa to fill the gap left by a halt of energy supplies from Russia. So even with Africa hosting the 2022 United Nations Climate Change Conference, many in the continent felt sidelined as Western industrialized countries dictated the agenda to reflect their geopolitical objectives. An activist who was frustrated at the COP27 summit speaks here.
I was so happy when they announced that COP will be in Africa, and I thought maybe we'll get a chance to be at the room where the negotiations are taking place. But today I can tell you I wasn't allowed to access the room. So I'm like, why are we here? Are we here to write around, or we are here for negotiations? So my worry is, even in Africa today, the COP is in Africa, but we have not been given a chance to speak. This is the one.
Now to discuss how Africa is a victim of climate change hypocrisy, we have contacted Nimo Basse, an environmental activist and author. Thanks a lot for joining us today, sir.
Thank you, Mohamed.
We also have with us Nefta Freeman of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Freeman.
Thank you for having me.
Now, let's start off with Mr. Nimo Basse. The COP27 climate summit held last November was dubbed the African COP due to its location in Egypt. Now, did Africa get the much-touted climate justice at this summit?
The short answer is Africa did not get any sense of climate justice from the summit. And secondly, calling it an African COP was very incorrect, because this was the fifth time such a conference was being held on the African continent, and none of it had ever been an African COP. So this was just a way to lull Africans to forget that this was a time to really fight for justice. I wouldn't get any of that at the end of the day.
The COP27 ended with what was branded a historic deal to create a new fund in which countries responsible for high carbon emissions will compensate vulnerable countries suffering from climate impacts. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, in a video message to COP27, said the conference has taken an important step towards climate justice, but insisted the step was not enough.
But let's be clear, our planet is still in the emergency room. We need to drastically reduce emissions now, and this is an issue this COP did not address. A fund for loss and damage is essential, but it's not an answer if the climate crisis washes a small island state off the map or turns an entire African country to desert. The world still needs a giant leap on climate ambition.
COP27's Loss and Damage Fund for developing countries has been termed a breakthrough. However, many critics insist that it is just another empty climate promise.
It wasn't by any means a breakthrough. It was just a little glimmer of what could actually happen. From what we heard before and after the conference, the rich countries, industrialized nations, who have caused global warming by their polluting activities, are unwilling to accept any sense of liability or to make the loss and damage a sense of climate reparation. What they want to make it tame like is just a token, like charity. But what the developing nations, the victims, actually need now
is a climate debt, which the global north, industrialized nations, do owe, and they should accept and pay a climate debt, not just paying for loss and damage while the damage continues.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has criticized Western nations' agreement to allow some fossil fuel investment while blocking Uganda's rights to retrieve oil and gas for itself as purist hypocrisy. Now, do you agree with the EU's parliament opposition to Uganda's oil pipeline project?
Well, there are a lot of contradictory signals going around in the world. The Western nations are still investing heavily in fossil fuel extraction, while at the same time acknowledging the fact that this is what is driving global warming. For us in Africa, it's also a double tragedy because our nations need a lot of financial resources, and at the same time, many of our political leaders don't care to think about the harm that comes from fossil fuel extraction. The communities in the oil fields of Uganda are really suffering. Some are displaced, and their lives have been totally shattered, and financing cannot resolve that kind of issue. So I believe it needs a lot of rethinking from both ends, from both the Ugandan, the African people, and from those who are driving expansion of fossil fuel extraction.
Now, African countries argue that they must be allowed to benefit from their fossil fuel reserves, as rich countries already have done. Now, experts say African countries are exporting their fossil fuels due to misplaced priorities.
Africa needs energy. We are not selling energy outside because we don't need it. We are selling energy outside because we have misplaced priorities.
An interesting aspect of the fossil fuel politics is that in Africa, fossil fuel exploration is extremely focused on the needs of the West. Western countries just care for their needs and do not want to see these fossil fuels being utilized for the benefit of the people of Africa.
Obviously, the global North or the Western nations have been extremely selfish in their approach to other regions of the world. What we're seeing now is a fossil colonialism, where in Africa and other regions are just seen as places to extract resources for the comfort of the West. They are unwilling to realign their lifestyles and consumption levels to the realities demanded by the need to tackle global warming. And so we're seeing a situation where the harm continues, exploitation continues, our environments continue to be trashed. And although our governments may receive some foreign exchange, may earn some foreign exchange, this can never be exchanged to what we are losing to meet the needs of the West. And up to 89% of the infrastructure, for example, for extraction of gas on the African continent is all aimed for exports to the West. And this is ridiculous. The needs of Africa have to be considered. And that is not being done as at now.
Let's now bring in Nefta Freeman. Africa itself has a huge energy deficit, yet the continent's gas is mostly delivered to Western countries. Now, do you think the new dash for African gas is another manifestation of colonial exploitation?
Yeah, this is a disposition that is a legacy of colonialism. It is what characterized neocolonialism. And in fact, it's not extends beyond the use of fossil fuels, but any type of raw minerals and things that are refined into finished goods that Africa has been used to supply the industrialized world with and make Western Europe rich and corporations and rich people rich. This extends to them. Their colonial mentality means that they want things for themselves, and they think that by virtue of domination and theft that they should be entitled to these things. Right now, we're seeing also the insatiable need of, you know, fueling modern industrialization and the war machine when it comes to fossil fuels. So modern industrialized countries, they use more fossil fuel and oil and gas than any other countries, and they get all of by and large all of that from other countries, and particularly in Africa right now. A lot of this is happening with Africa, and they fuel wars, and that in fact they go to war for it.
Well, very well put there. The current fossil fuel politics is characterized by neocolonialism perpetrated by Western powers. We'll now take a short break before we continue with our topic for today on how Africa is a victim of climate change hypocrisy. Stay with us.
Africa, a victim of climate change hypocrisy.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Africa is a continent paying for the devastating effects of a climate change crisis it did not ignite. A Somali elder elaborates here on the horrific effects of climate change. Climate change is certainly having a catastrophic impact on many African countries. Now, should the development of Africa be put on hold until the climate crisis is over?
The short answer is no. But Africa has to determine what is the type of development, what is development, and where do we want to go? If we want to go the way of the West, that's the wrong direction to take, because we can see where that has led the world now. So the issue of extracting natural resources so as to develop Africa is not really true, because right from slavery to colonialism to neocolonialism, extraction of resources on the continent have always benefited elsewhere, the other, not the region. So it's a time to really re-examine. We have the concept, the philosophy, we know what we need, we know what the people in the community, our communities require. Do we know the African philosophy of development, of the good life, for example? What does it mean to live well? We need to do some inward looking. Otherwise, we always fall victim to this kind of exploitation, inequity, and injustices that we're seeing in the world today.
I will put the same question to Mr. Freeman. Now, do you think Africa should reduce or stop using fossil fuels due to pressure from Western industrialized countries?
Absolutely not. The development of Africa and no other places should be put on hold until the climate crisis is saved. It can only be saved with the development of some of these places. It's the overuse, the overconsumption, the misuse by the so-called developed countries that exacerbates the climate crisis. We have to also remember that all means of eradicating poverty are actually in contradiction with advanced late-stage capitalism, neoliberalism, and the Western world. So the things that need to happen for poverty to be eradicated are actually in contradiction or aren't antithetical to the different policies and developments or things that sustain the Western world, and also at the same time exacerbate the climate crisis. So the only solution is for there to be people-centered movements for socialism. And they were talking about bottom-up movements where the global non-white working class and peasant classes depose white supremacy, capitalism, and patriarchy, and establish a system when we say people-centered, and establishing a system that actually establishes real participatory democracy by those most impacted by these issues.
Moussa Faki Mahamat, the chairman of the African Union Commission, says African countries are already forced to spend between 2% and 5% of their gross domestic product each year to deal with the climate change problem they did not create. This is one of the most shocking injustices against the continent.
While I don't lay much stock on measurements of the gross domestic product, I do believe that the figures being brought out by the chair of the AU actually underscores the fact of climate injustice that we all reject and campaign against. Africa is already being forced to bear the burden of tackling global warming by our forests, our resources being used either as carbon sinks or providing resources for energy for others and not for the continent. And this is something that requires real action by the African Union and other vulnerable regions who are suffering the same kind of discrimination, the kind of overloading of the responsibility of climate action. It's a time to call for a people's conference of parties and not just this routine ritual that keeps heaping more problems on the victims.
U.S. climate envoy John Kerry was quoted as saying that African countries should not invest in natural gas projects. Yet, in the space of just 6 years, the U.S. LNG industry has become the largest in the world, overtaking both Qatar and Australia. Let's take a listen.
Gas could be used as a transition. And we're not saying no gas. What we're saying is that over the next few years, gas replaces coal or replaces oil, that's good. But after 2030, it's going to be important to be able to capture the emissions from gas too.
Can we say that this statement by Kerry aptly captured the political position by the imperialist powers?
Well, what I would really like to ask Mr. Kerry is, does that same statement apply to the United States, or does it apply only to Africa? We need a system, a situation where justice will require that Africa follows the pattern of development that maintains our environment, that keeps our culture, and that meets our aspirations, and that no one dictates to the continent what the continent must do.
The industrialization of Western countries was made possible by the exploitation of Africa's natural resources. Just as is the case surrounding the payments of reparations for African enslavement and colonization by Europe and North America, Western powers are not accepting responsibility for the harm done in the past or the present. During the COP27 summit, Kenyan President William Ruto expressed concern that industrialized countries have defaulted in their pledges to help mitigate climate disasters.
The pledge made 13 years ago in Copenhagen, committing US dollars $100 billion annually, remains unfulfilled. Such a gracious and unexplained default is a major cause of persisting distrust, and neither is there any sound reason for the continuing pollution. In stark contrast, Kenya, a country with far less resources than the average developed country, has foregone pollution industrialization and growth opportunities and intentionally invested in clean, green energy.
Do African countries have options in compelling industrialized countries to embrace climate justice and fulfill their pledges to financially assist poor countries that are bearing the brunt of climate change?
We have to remember that the different countries also have a class composition to them. So the industrialized country, I mean, we shouldn't only see it as the embodiment or the embodiment of it is only the interests of their ruling classes and their elite class. So in all of the industrialized countries, there is a dispossessed working class communities, a lot of them non-white, and even in the European countries, or it's particularly in the U.S. as a settler colony. What that means is that the only hope of reparations for, and which actually should be seen in a more sophisticated way, is not just money payments, but the repair. Reparations is a repairing of the harms done to a people, that can only come, and particularly to African people, can only come with Pan-Africanism.
The bulk of exploration for new oil and gas resources in Africa is carried out and financed by foreign companies. Now, this has made African countries vulnerable to manipulation by Western powers. So what can Africa learn from Iran that has attained a high level of self-sufficiency in its fossil fuel projects?
Well, one of the main things it can learn is that it needs to stand up to imperialism. I mean, just to acquiesce to imperialism hasn't gotten the African countries and the comprador class, which is really serving themselves, anywhere. And in fact, another thing that it can learn from countries like Iran, but other countries, is that these countries are coming together and formations that would be tantamount to a new non-aligned movement that we saw in the 50s and the 60s, where they are not. They're saying, well, we have to look at our own interests instead of being seen as only serving the interests of either, of global powers. Then we define our own interests. And in doing that, we also connect and cooperate and collaborate with other international countries to try to withstand the aggressions of imperialism. And so this is very important for African countries to understand.
Well, there you have it. African countries should be part of the new world order that withstands the aggression of imperialism. Unfortunately, our time is up for today. I would like to thank our guests, Nefta Freeman and Nimo Basay, for their incisive analysis. And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. Goodbye for now.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication, and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned. Allahumma wa as'aluka su'ala man ishtaddat faqata wa anzala bika inda ash-shada'id hajata wa 'azma fi ma 'indaka raghbata Allahumma Brothers and sisters, in the previous program, we started talking about this part of Kumail's supplication. Allahumma 'azuma sultanuk. O Allah, great is your kingdom. Wa 'ala makanuk. Lofty is your being. Wa khafiya makruk. O Allah, your contrivance is hidden. For those of you who may not know the meaning of contrivance, we have to mention that it means something like deceitfulness with regards to Almighty Allah's beings, which is used for deceiving others. But applying this word and this meaning to the Almighty Allah is not right, because it is the attribute of the incapable. It is the attribute of the unwise human beings. And as you all, dear listeners, know, incapability and ignorance is not part of the holy essence of the Almighty. His holy essence is holy knowledge. It is holy might, mercy, and generosity. All the beings are in need of him, and he is the one which is needless. He is the absolute cause. So, contrivance with regards to the Almighty Allah means chastisement and punishment. This is what some scholars have mentioned. He would use it for those who deserve it. He would use these chastisements and punishments. And this is what is meant by khafiya makruk. Your contrivance is hidden means the people who are subject to his chastisement and punishment, they have no escape from it. One interesting aspect to be discussed is that his chastisement for those who commit sins arrogantly and ignorantly are in different ways. One way is that it is gradual, in which case as the ignorant sinner increases his wrongdoing, Almighty Allah adds to his blessings so that the servant's ignorance would be enhanced by the increased blessings. He would forget about Almighty Allah. He would forget about from whom these blessings are coming from. As a result, the sinner is about to forget a repentance. And then suddenly chastisement befalls without the sinner's attention, without him being aware, and he will be entangled. And the chastisement will avenge him. In fact, the sinner would face the hidden contrivance in this case.
Oh Allah, I beg as one whose neediness is extreme and who supplicates his knees to you and whose desire for that which is with you has become great. Oh Allah, great is your kingdom and exalted is your greatness. Your plan is secret. Your authority is manifest, your might is victorious and subduing, and your power is prevalent throughout, and it is not possible to escape from your dominion. O Allah, apart from you, I do not find anyone able to pardon my sins.
nor to conceal my shameful acts, nor do I have anyone except you to change my evil deeds into virtues. There is no God but you. Glory and praise be to you. I have oppressed my own soul. I had the audacity to sin by my ignorance. I have relied upon my ancient remembrance of you and your grace towards me. Oh Allah, my Lord, how many of my ugly deeds have you concealed? How many of my grievous afflictions have you abolished? And how many stumblings of mine have you prevented? How many of my detestable acts have you averted? And how many of my undeserving praises have you spread abroad?
Thank you, Allah,
now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever.
The ocean of dua.
In this regard, there is a very interesting tradition narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. He alayhi salam says, "Idha arada Allahu bi'abdin khayran." In fact, sometimes Almighty Allah wills to give His servant blessings and goodness. فَأَذْنَبَ ذَنْبًا أَتْبَعَهُ بِنِعْمَةٍ وَيُذَكِّرُهُ الْإِسْتِغْفَارِ. If that servant commits sins, Almighty Allah would give him blessings, and the servant becomes warned and repentant. وَإِذَا أَرَادَ بِعَبْدٍ شَرًّا فَأَذْنَبَ ذَنْبًا أَتْبَعَهُ بِنِعْمَةٍ لِيُنْسِيَهُ الْإِسْتِغْفَارِ وَتَمَادَى بِهَا. Sometimes, on the other hand, he wills evil for a servant. Of course, it means that the servant has started doing evil things and he is not going to be back. It continues, then he grants blessings to the sinner after his wrongdoing. So the servant gets entertained by the blessings and hence he becomes more ignorant. He would thus forget repentance, and his sins continue due to the blessings. وَهُوَ قَوْلُهُ. This is what Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says. هُوَ قَوْلُهُ سَنَسْتَدْرِجُهُمْ مِنْ حَيْثُ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ. This is the sense of Almighty Allah saying, we draw them near to destruction by degrees from whence they would not know. In fact, this is one possible meaning of the phrase, وَخَفِيَ مَكْرُكُ, and your contrivance is hidden. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program as well. وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَيْكُمْ وَرَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ وَبَرَكَاتُهُ.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Be with me.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.